The world is going through changes. Changes happening at a speed that we have never seen before. This is leading to disruption, chaos, panic, fear, hysteria, and a turbulent economy and marketplace. How do you protect your wealth in a turbulent world? How do you invest for cash flow and alternative assets to escape the rat race in times of uncertainty? How do you decentralize yourself, your family, your community, your business, and your investments to become sovereign and escape the matrix? If you are looking for strategies, tactics, and techniques to escape the rat race and matrix, you are in the right place. My name is MC Lobsher, and this is Cashflow Ninja. This is Cashflow Ninja. I am MC Lobsher. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode and spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. If you are a regular listener or a new listener, here are five ways I can help you right now. You could go to cashflowninja.com and listen to all of my podcasts. I've recorded over 1,000 podcasts with the best minds in business and investing. You can download all of my books in which I share the best alternative asset investment niches. You can watch our free trainings on infinite banking, Midas banking, Bitcoin life insurance, strategic metals, and more. You can subscribe to my weekly newsletter, which is free, The Wealth Dojo, in which I share the best insights on alternative wealth strategies and alternative asset investing you will find anywhere. And finally, you can join our community, The Wealth Dojo, and get access to the best training, strategy, and community in the alternative wealth strategy and alternative asset investing space, period. My guests in this episode are Steve Austin and Zach Murphy. Steve and Zach, great to see you guys.
Great to see you, MC.
Yeah, great to see you, MC.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to our conversation of this very, very unique cash flow strategy that you're involved with. But before we dive into that, for our listeners and viewers that are not familiar with you and what you're doing, can you just please share a little bit about your background and journey and what you're up to these days?
Yeah, sure. So Steve Austin, I'm one of the partners here at American Revitalization Company, ARC for short. My background is pretty diverse. I spent a lot of time in financial services, about 15 plus years there. I worked in the private equity space early in my career as an operator of a business for a large private equity firm. I've worked in the public sector. I was an executive in a sales capacity for a closely held public company back in the day. And I've started and grown and scaled my own businesses. So very diverse background.
Yeah, mine's a little shorter than Steve here, but I'm Zach Murphy. I'm the president of our capital markets team here. So my background was in financial services. And for the past 3 years, I've been more in a capital raising role. So the past 3 years, I've been a part of a team that's raised $75 million plus. So really working with our investors, working with our referral partners, since we get a lot of our investors from financial advisors and CPAs and, you know, different referral sources. So working on those relationships, working with the clients, and, you know, working with our team here on the investor services side. That's a lot of my background right there.
Awesome. So you guys are involved in historical preservation, easement, cash flow strategies with ARC. So can you explain just what is that, and then how do they work?
Yeah, so a lot of people are not familiar with some of the benefits of investing in historical real estate, and some people also think when you say historic real estate, you're only talking about these buildings that are dilapidated, falling apart, and kind of unusable or unrentable. And so what we focus on are actually kind of the other end of that market. We focus on cash flowing assets as much as possible. Not 100% of our assets are going to be cash flowing, but the bulk of what we do is find buildings that are already on the National Park Service's registry, that they're either individually listed as a historic asset or they're a contributing asset in what's referred to as a historic downtown district. And so oftentimes these are in cities like Birmingham, where we are today, Raleigh, North Carolina, Miami, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio. These are all cities that have a tremendous amount of historic inventory. And I think the National Park Service says there's about 1.8 million individually listed buildings, MC. And then as wow. part of these districts, there's probably north of 10 million. So it's just kind of an underutilized asset class is kind of how we ended up getting into this. And it brings in a lot of tax benefits. And I'm happy to get into that if you'd like me to.
Yeah, it's fascinating because even where I live in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of historic buildings here in Absolutely. The old colonial buildings. And you kind of drive past it, but you've never really thought about the strategy around this that is just available for all investors. So let's get into how these work and what the process looks like.
Sure. Yeah. So We structure it in a fund, and each year will be a new fund. And the reason it's done that way, MC, is because our investors get a pretty substantial charitable tax deduction based on the historic buildings that we preserve. So we don't just buy these cash flowing historic buildings; we actually preserve them from future development. So we put what's called a historic facade easement, or an HPE. On the building so that it protects any upward or outward development of that building, and it maintains the exterior of it in that historic condition. Now that still lets you do anything you want with the interior of the building, including, you know, as long as zoning allows it, you know, use changes from office to condos or whatever you need to do there to optimize your investment. But when you put this facade easement on the building, you are allowed to take a charitable deduction, which can offset up to 50% of your taxable income, your AGI. And you can do that each and every year. And so our investors are getting these, you know, very large charitable deductions, and we limit it, you know, we limit it to 2.5 times what you would invest into the fund. And then we also produce cash flow with some additional investments that we can get into later. And then there's some other tax programs that I'll mention. So when you do a renovation or a rehab on some of these buildings, there's also something called an HTC, a historic tax credit. And those are generally available both from the federal and the state level. And they will cover as much as 50% of the renovations. And so that provides a substantial return to the investors as well. So there's a couple of different programs in the historic sector that we look at taking advantage of.
So it seems like there's obviously an incentive that the government has put up for these buildings. And I mean, you could look at our economy and what is incentivized, like with real estate, right? They don't want to be a landlord, so they need other landlords to get into the real estate game and provide affordable housing. They don't necessarily want to get into the energy business, so you need entrepreneurs in energy, whether it be your old and tried and true and trusted forms of energy, or whether it be your newer ones, right? And there's incentives for them in there. And then, of course, there's other incentives around, not developing land and so forth. I could see why there's incentives for this, because there's culturally significant buildings exactly. that are historic, that's been culturally part of a community, which really to preserve that is huge, because you're preserving that cultural heritage in that mm-hmm. specific town. So I could see that there's a huge net benefit to society to do Absolutely. This, which is, if you look at the tax codes, that's exactly what it is, right? There's a list of incentives which a lot of people get to benefit from. And if you do things yeah. in a proper manner and play the tax game well, then you're going to be able to invest and grow your capital, serve more people as you're doing that. And then therefore you get the tax incentives. It's the same for business owners, right? That's yep. why business owners and, let's just say a just an employee and a self-employed person, there's obviously different tax
strategies.
Regulations, yeah, and that they're underneath, because if you're a business owner, you're generating value to the marketplace through your products and services and solving a lot of problems. And while you're doing all of this, you're hiring more people, creating more jobs, absolute net benefit to society. So I just want to set that table too for folks that it's not – this is not the philosophy here isn't like, hey, this is how you, like, you know, reduce a tax bill. It's like you got to step back, big picture, and look at what's actually happening and where this all fits in and the reasons why there are these benefit or these incentives in place, because it is a net benefit to overall to society, right?
Yeah, to society, to the communities, and you know, the job creation, like you mentioned. And, you know, really, we look at it a couple of ways. You know, we are providing all of those benefits that Congress, you know, really had said, okay, hey, we'll give you this incentive if you do X, Y, and Z. So you know, these are all, you know, what I think most people probably understand that every single thing in the tax code is congressionally enacted, right? So, you know, our government has taken the time to put this into the tax code because they want to incentivize this to happen. And so we look at it and say, well, that's an opportunity to create alpha for our investors where other people might not see the opportunity. And so it's an opportunistic play on our part. And we think that there's a really good societal benefit and cultural value to what we're doing. So, you know, we enjoy that aspect of it as well. But yeah, you're correct. It's really taking advantage of that excess alpha that's available in the tax code.
How do you achieve clarity, certainty, and predictability in a world economy and markets that are volatile and chaotic? How do you have confidence in an environment where change and disruption is constant? Setting up infinite banking is how you establish certainty in an uncertain world, predictability in an unpredictable world. With an infinite banking policy, you have your capital warehoused outside of the Wall Street casino, where it is guaranteed never to go down in value, and guaranteed to grow tax-free. You have guaranteed access to your capital, and you also will be able to access your capital tax-free to use to capitalize on opportunities as you come across them. Creating your own banking system with infinite banking can be your secret weapon to protect and grow wealth during turbulent times. You can watch a presentation and explore infinite banking options for you and your family at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. And if you think about it, I just had this thought that there are so many other shinier objects out in the alternative asset investment world that people are rushing to, that this could eventually, I mean, because a lot of investors have just overlooked this. If you think about it, then all these culturally significant kind of historic buildings that has been there for a long time and is kind of part of a community, they're just going to get dilapidated. And eventually, I mean, what's going to happen to it? You're just going to have to knock it down and it's gone, right? And put some really ugly, newer architectural building in its place, and you lose all of that. I mean, look at all of our cities in the United States. I mean, if you travel around, which it's been a blessing to do it. You go to all these older towns, I'll just throw out names there, even like Detroit, Cleveland. I mean, all these cities, and you guys are in Birmingham. What a fantastic city that is too. There's all, and I could just keep going on and naming all of these with so much history and character, the buildings and the historic like buildings that's in there. It's just incredible. I mean, you think about, thinking of the Cleveland one too. I was walking around their downtown. I'm like, man, this place, there was stuff going on here. And then you're like, well, the Rockefellers from Ohio, right? So they had a ton of real estate there. There's a ton
and that downtown waterfront in Cleveland has been completely revitalized. And a lot of that was done using these types of tax incentives to finance those transactions. So, you know, it does work. You know, it's a great benefit to the cities when people can take these advantages.
Yeah. So a win-win for investors, a win for the community and the cities and the towns. And then, it's a win-win all around the table for all the parties that are involved with it. Let's walk through the process.
Yeah. So, we identify assets on a traditional real estate underwriting metric, right? So we're looking at, rents and markets and, zoning, what can we do with the building? If, for example, there's a lot of opportunity in office space right now. And, what if office doesn't come back? What can you potentially turn that building into? So we look at all of those things like a traditional real estate investment firm would. But then at the same time, we're also doing all of our underwriting on what the potential tax benefits are. And we start with the facade easement. We have to value what that facade easement is going to end up being worth in the end. And so we've developed a really good underwriting method to get very, very close to where the final appraisals come in. And beyond that, we look at, is there a historic tax credit play in place? We look at, 179D was recently improved in the Inflation Reduction Act. And so now property owners can get upwards of $5 a square foot for making energy efficiency upgrades to the building, lighting, HVAC controls, things of that nature. And so how do we, is there an opportunity for that there? And then lastly, we dive into, all of the, traditional depreciation and cost seg studies and things like that, that most real estate investors are now doing. And so once we've decided that an asset kind of meets our criteria, we'll put it under contract. We'll go into due diligence. And we do have an extended due diligence period, from most buyers, but we're also coming to the table as a cash buyer, which a lot of sellers are happy about right now, because let's face it, in the commercial mortgage space, it's tough to get loans right now. And we work with sellers or developers. So we don't necessarily always, buy an on-market property. We'll work, developers will call us and want to partner with us on deals, and we'll bring part of the capital. They'll bring part of the capital. And so so what we're doing is we're finding and identifying these assets. We're underwriting them on our kind of profile. We put them under contract. We start a pre-feasibility, which is going to be, what's the zoning? We get a zoning opinion. We do title searches. We do all kind of the kind of traditional stuff that a developer would do to determine the highest and best use of the property. And so in most markets that we're in, the highest and best use is going to be some form of housing or hospitality or combination thereof. And so we design a, maximally productive building on that site that we are legally allowed to build. And then we essentially don't build it. So we go through all the steps of designing, a 40-story apartment tower that the zoning attorneys and everybody said, okay, yeah, this is something that's permitted that you could do on this site. And we don't have to actually go to the step of getting approvals from the city. We just have to design it, right? And then we send all of that data and a market study off to the bank, to the appraiser, just like you would if you were trying to get a construction loan as a developer. And the appraiser, tears it apart, goes through all the data, looks at your design, your market studies to kind of validate it. And then they crunch the numbers and say, if you built this and stabilized it, this is what it would value at in this market. And they use usually a sales comp approach to do that. And then, after we've designed it and determined what the value is, we deduct the cost of construction from that. And that's there's some other calculations that go into it. But in layman's terms, the delta between the valuation of the building stabilized and the construction cost is the charitable deduction.
I am super excited to announce that I have launched the Cashflow Ninja Niches Book Trilogy. Three books, the 21 best cashflow niches, the 21 most unique cashflow niches, and the 21 best cash growth niches. In the three books, I feature a total of 66 different alternative asset investment niches. You know what's the best part? I'm giving it all away for free. When you go to cashflowninja.com, you can download the 21 best cash flow niches, the 21 most unique cash flow niches, and the 21 best cash growth niches in digital and audio format for free. If you're like me and you like physical books, you can buy all three books on Amazon. Just go to cashflowninja.com/Amazon and it'll take you to all three books. I want to thank every single listener from the bottom of my heart for riding along on this journey with me since 2016. You touched on the financing for these. That seemed, and a lot of this is bought cash, right? But that is the one aspect that I'm, when you were sharing this in the beginning too, I'm like, man, that's gotta be like brutal. Who would, you know, just knowing what I know on the commercial side of some of the projects that I've been involved with, that's a brutal side of this right now in this environment, right?
It is.
And that's really a huge advantage to us being a cash buyer with the high interest rates we're currently seeing. A lot of capital is sitting on the sidelines. A lot of the people, especially people who've come on your podcast, are talking about this is not a good opportunity to buy for them because they're relying on a pretty large amount of their capital to be from debt. We don't use any debt in our models. So we actually feel like this is a great time to buy because there's a lot of capital sitting on the sideline. There's not a ton of competition to buy these buildings. So we're really excited about the buying opportunity for the current interest rate environment for us as a cash buyer.
And for anybody listening, you might say, well, why wouldn't you use debt? I mean, and the answer is when we put the facade easement on the building, we actually are not allowed to have encumbrances on the building. So we have to actually, you know, submit that facade easement with the building debt free, but that doesn't prevent us from pulling debt down the road. So, you know, if the interest rate environment improves, we can do a cash out refi for our investors. So we have the flexibility, but, you know, coming to the market as a cash buyer in this environment has been a big advantage.
And then you had mentioned some of this is converted into something else. For example, if it was an old historic building where there was offices in, and you preserve the integrity of the building and all of the historical features with it and so forth, you can on the inside convert those to apartments and other uses, right?
Yeah. So whatever the zoning permits in the municipality that you're in, you can any, you know, mixed use, you know, office, retail, condos, hospitality, and you can do anything you want to the interiors of these buildings. It's really what we're protecting is all of the exterior features, materials, windows, things of that nature.
Those historical buildings are great event spaces too, I've noticed. I mean, there's something about it as an event space where folks come in and they enjoy the beauty of it. And obviously the event that they're attending, whether it be a you know, small gathering or a wedding and so forth, they're fantastic for that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're looking at a couple of those right now out in the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, every building of those buildings has a story, right? Tell me about the pitfalls to watch out for this. Like, how does this go wrong, and what are some of the risks?
Yeah, I mean, we're taking a lot of the risk out of the real estate side of our business, and you know, really, what I tell investors is our biggest risk is going to be the execution risk on the business portfolio that we're putting together. Because in addition to these historic buildings, because we're limiting the charitable deduction, you know, at a lower level, you know, just to keep it conservative from a, you know, a litigation standpoint with the IRS, that creates excess capital that we deploy into buying what we refer to as legacy industrial manufacturing businesses. And so these are, if you want to just kind of a typical profile of businesses we buy, it's going to be a baby boomer or a second, third generation owner who is looking to sunset into retirement, and they don't really have a succession plan in place. And so we work with them to take over that company. And you know, typically these companies are doing in the 1 to 2 million of an EBITDA range per year. And we'll buy those somewhere between, you know, kind of the market rate right now is 2 to 3 times EBITDA. So you know, if you buy $1 million of EBITDA for $3 million, you're effectively generating a 33% cash on cash return, which is what our investors are really excited about. So, that's kind of the biggest downfall that we have is, you know, the execution risk on building that portfolio of companies for the investors. But again, we're doing everything, you know, for the most part, debt free. You know, we will buy some equipment and you know, stuff like that on debt for some of the manufacturing businesses. But really, the purchases are all done debt free. So we've taken away that big risk that you get into with you know, most of these types of small businesses or, you know, commercial real estate right now. And we use all the tax incentives that are available to us to, you know, increase the returns that our investors are getting, whether it's the upfront charitable deduction that you get, you know, when you invest in, we do the facade easements, whether it's, you know, a historic tax credit, you know, 18 months after we buy a building and we renovate it, we get, you know, a couple $1 million back on these historic tax credits. You know, like I mentioned, 179D. In the manufacturing space, we think the R&D tax credits are going to come back, and that'll be big in the manufacturing sector as well. So we're always looking for ways to add alpha, which, you know, essentially de-risks these investments. But it's always, you know, your biggest pitfall is always going to come down to the team that's executing.
It's not a liquid investment. You can't sell out of your limited partnership ownership. So it's accredited investors only. Obviously, we have about a 6-year time horizon on our investments. So if you needed that capital for something else, that's another risk, is that we're not a liquid stock. We're not a publicly traded REIT. We're a syndicated real estate transaction where you go where we go. So that's really the big risk is the execution risk with us and the time horizon for us.
Some of my listeners might be, they just picked up, there's some companies that are being purchased too. So if we can just take a step back. So you guys have, let's just say, a fund. And in this fund, you're buying these historical buildings.
Yep.
But you're also adding other manufacturing businesses in this portfolio of companies that are all part of the same fund. Could you just go back and explain that a little bit? Because I think that's something that we missed.
Sure. Yeah. So because we limit the charitable deduction, We don't take a 5 or 6 or 10 to 1 deduction. We limit it at 2.5 times what our investors put into the fund. That determines how much capital we have to raise on each project. And so what it ultimately does is creates about a third of the capital that we raise is left over at the end of the year. And so after we've done all the historic buildings and done all the facade easements, and, you know, if we're going to do a tax credit, you know, renovation, then that money's already set aside. That roughly 30% of the investor capital, we turn around and we deploy that into this manufacturing sector. And we did that because it's very synergistic from a tax standpoint with what we're doing. So we create a lot of very tax advantaged income for our investors, which is the kind of the primary goal of the fund. And we even use a very tax efficient exit strategy when we sell these businesses. We sell them through what's called an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan. So we're taking these kind of legacy, you know, kind of really important, vital American manufacturing companies, and we're consolidating, you know, 5, 10, 20 of these companies into one operating business, okay, with different divisions that all have different capabilities. So we might buy a couple of, you know, CNC shops. We might buy a couple of fabrication shops on the metal side. We're buying a couple of plastics companies. And the idea is that we can create a large, mid to large size, you know, manufacturing conglomerate that we will ultimately transition to an employee-owned business. And so further protecting those American jobs and communities that we're already investing in. And, you know, because of the inefficiencies in the private equity market, you know, most private equity groups aren't buying businesses this small. So it allows us to buy these businesses at, you know, the current multiples are in the 2 to 3 range. You know, I've seen deals as low as 1x. And these companies, these manufacturing businesses tend to have very significant balance sheets. You can, you know, usually we're not paying much more than the liquidation value of the equipment. So it's a very secure investment, which, you know, tends to, you know, match well with real estate investors. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we're generating 30 to 50% cash on cash returns, you know, without the debt. And if we leverage them up and put debt on the companies, you know, in a responsible way, obviously in this environment, but if we take that opportunity down the road, it's going to enhance the returns.
I want to acknowledge one of our sponsors. Are you ready to ride the wave of success in the booming car wash industry? Tommy's Express Car Wash is the cutting-edge brand that is revolutionizing the way we clean vehicles. Demand for top-notch, state-of-the-art tunnel car wash is skyrocketing. Institutions are diving in headfirst, and the real asset investor is already a step ahead. They have a world-class operations team, and they're building a portfolio of Tommy's Express car washes that's on track to become one of the largest privately owned car wash portfolios in the United States. The margins on a stabilized Tommy's Express car wash are incredible, and accredited investors have the chance to join them on their adventure. Dave Zook, the founder and CEO of The Real Asset Investor, and his team are thrilled to share opportunities like Tommy's Car Wash with accredited investors that boost your cash flow, unlocks massive tax benefits, and get you set up for a lucrative exit just a few years from now. To learn more about the opportunities offered by The Real Asset Investor, you can reach out to them at info@therealassetinvestor.com. That's info@therealassetinvestor.com. So on the first side of this strategy is the historical buildings. And on the piece then is then the manufacturing, American manufacturing businesses of a certain size that you're then purchasing and kind of merging together into one under one entity, and then that's all together in this fund. So you have on the one side the historical buildings, the tax advantages of that, and some cash flow if it's turned into something like apartments or event spaces and so forth. And then on the other side you have the businesses, which is already generating cash flow from day one, which is generating obviously then returns for investors.
That's right. Immediate cash flow. That's what we're looking for, is we're trying to generate as much cash flow over the roughly 6-year hold period as we can. And then because we're buying a bunch of small pieces and we're buying them at the lower multiples that I mentioned, by the time we aggregate them and go to sell them, now the business is so large that the comparable sales are probably in the 8 to 12 multiple range. So we do a lot of value creation there for the investors. And because we're doing an ESOP exit, it's a tax deferred, similar to a 1031 in real estate, MC. There's a 1042 exchange when you sell your business to the employees, which we take advantage of. So all of our investors, they're going to get back U.S. stocks or bonds. So usually, like, we'll take the proceeds of the sale, we'll make the 1042 election, we'll buy treasuries, and then we'll distribute the treasuries in kind to our investors. And so that's how they get to control their tax bite on that return that we just generated over 5 or 6 years. They can dictate when and if they want to ever pay that tax bill. You know, so it's a very tax efficient strategy.
So really, MC, what we're trying to do is take an investment that's just a standard single or a double, and then utilize these tax incentives to turn it into a triple or a home run. And we feel, in today's current interest rate environment, that that's a really solid strategy to add that extra alpha into your portfolio, is utilize these tax savings and turn it into cash flow. Basically take money that you're giving to the government and put it back into your pocket, which I feel like fits really well with your podcast listeners, is we're trying to not take their investment dollars, we're trying to take their tax dollars and give it back to them.
What's the timeline on this, more or less, that you guys are looking for? You mentioned 5 to 6 years, but what is it? What is the kind of the timeline that you're looking from one project or from the beginning towards the exit of it?
Yeah, so that first phase, which, you know, we call it the front end of the fund, which is buying the real estate and doing the historic preservation, that all happens kind of in the year we raise the capital, right? So that's all done by December 31st each year. And then when you get into what we effectively call year two, right, which would be, you know, in this case, if somebody invested in 2024, we're now into 2025, we're deploying the second half of that capital into the manufacturing. And so that'll usually take about 6 to 9 months to get everything deployed and then to start, you know, streamlining the operations and adding our efficiencies and things like that. And so really the full cash flow generally is hitting our investors by the end of year two or the beginning of year three. And from that point forward, we're doing quarterly distributions. And so we have a very, you know, consistent process for kind of deploying our capital. And it's very scalable for us, which is, you know, pretty exciting. And then, you know, we have to hold the businesses a minimum of 3 years to qualify for the 1042 exchange on the back end. So 3 years from the last acquisition is kind of, you know, the threshold that we have to get over, you know, from a timing perspective. And if we participate in a project that has historic tax credits involved, you have a 5-year mandatory hold, so you don't have to recapture any of those credits. So basically, we've set everything so that beginning in year 5, we know we can start liquidating our assets and getting capital back to the investors. So the way the fund is structured on the, you know, our side as the manager is we're taking a very significant incentive to perform on the back end. So most of what we make is only going to come if we perform at the levels that we believe we're able to when we're selling these businesses, which, you know, again, it takes away some of the risk to the investors of, you know, exorbitant fees and things like that you see on some syndication deals. And so, you know, that's, you know, we're probably in that 5 to 6 year window from the time investors give us money until they're fully liquidated and they get their returns. But the cash flow will start, you know, usually at the end of year two.
But you can always extend that hold if needed to be, depending on the environment, to 10 mm-hmm. years or and so
That's
forth.
Right. And so yeah, it's a 10 plus one structure.
In an environment that is challenging like today, there's no, I think people have gotten so used to from 2012 to like 2022 of like these 3 to 5 year holds and exits on a lot of assets. I'm like, that's not the environment. Yeah. Anymore. That's not the world.
Not sustainable for sure.
No, not sustainable. And when the environment changes, you have to be able to adapt and have something in place. Quick question on the exit too. So this ESOP that you're talking about in the 1042. So this might be the first time that a lot of listeners and viewers have heard that. So can we just touch on that again? So what you're doing is you're selling the companies to the employees, right?
That's right. So the way an ESOP works is it's the same thing as a leveraged buyout, except the difference is instead of, you know, a private equity company bringing debt to the table and levering up a business like this, a bank, an insurance company, they like to lend to these ESOPs. And ESOP is essentially like a qualified retirement account. It's ERISA protected. It follows all of those ERISA statutes. And there's an independent trustee that's appointed over the employee's retirement account. And that independent trustee goes out and independently verifies the valuation of the business that we're selling. And so generally they'll use like the middle of the three valuations or maybe an average of the three to kind of determine the purchase price so that it's an arm's length transaction from us. But ultimately the bank or the insurance company will loan the money to the employee's retirement account to buy all of the shares of the company from our investors. And, you know, the reason they like to lend to these particular strategies is because once 100% of the company is owned inside of the ESOP, it's a tax-free business, right? So all of the cash burn that was going to service federal and state taxes is now there to service the debt load on top of the EBITDA. So it becomes a very good transaction for the lender as well. And ultimately what happens is once we have exited and sold that to the investors, 100% of the company shares get distributed down to the employees based on their tenure and income, based on a plan that the trustees and the board of directors puts together. So over a period of a few years, now the employees own 100% of the shares of the company. And so whatever's left, whatever income is left in the company after they have serviced all the debt, that all gets divvied up based on the equity inside your retirement account. So now these employees will have very substantial retirements when the time comes.
Gotcha. So a win-win on the back end for them too. And there's an incentive for the employees because I think what you see a lot when companies are being purchased for the purpose of resale, let's just say in the private equity world, we see that all the time, is sometimes you get a workforce that gets demoralized, right? Because they're like, well, they're just really trying to squeeze as much juice out of us as they possibly can, and then sell us to the next person. So this is actually where you align the interest of the employees of the company, and that could, you know, obviously get them very motivated.
And a very well-known company in your area that has used this is Wawa. Wawa, or for those that are in, you know, the South, Buc-ee's, Publix, these are all employee-owned companies. And it drives a lot of benefits, not just on the employee side, but these companies tend to be, you know, more profitable because you have a workforce that owns the business.
I knew about Wawa. I didn't know about Buc-ee's. That's very interesting. And by the way, fantastic road stops if you're doing a road trip down the South. That's fantastic.
They just put one in about 20 minutes from my house on the way to Atlanta. So every time we go to the in-laws, you got to stop and grab a sandwich.
It's fantastic. We are in the beginning of another Bitcoin cycle. Many listeners and viewers have reached out to me asking me how they can safely buy, secure, and store Bitcoin, and how they can set up an automated Bitcoin savings account. I've used Swan Bitcoin to dollar cost average throughout the entire Bitcoin cycle with an automated Bitcoin savings account. You can start your Bitcoin savings account at www.swanbitcoin.com/cashflowninja and get $10 free in Bitcoin. From a risk standpoint in the fund itself, what are some of the risks of combining the historical buildings and then with the other businesses and the fund? And how are you guys navigating that?
Yeah, that's a good question, MC. I mean, it really comes down to you have different risks in real estate, right? You have tenant risks, you have credit risks, you have all of those types of risks. And then on the manufacturing side, on the business portfolio, you know, you have risks that, you know, the economy is going to, you know, turn around and, you know, the customers that we're providing, you know, these services to are going to, you know, stop ordering. Right. And so that's the biggest risk. And, you know, I keep harping on this, but, you know, the fact that we don't use debt in these transactions in this environment where, you know, where markets are at all time highs and interest rates are, you know, still very high, and, you know, inflation has been very persistent right now, and we don't know if interest rates are going to come down anytime soon. So this may be the new normal, right? This, you know, this could take 24, 36 months just for everybody to just accept and realize that, hey, this is the new normal going forward, and this is where we're going to be. And, you know, so we're well positioned to navigate those challenges and those downturns if they do come. And you know, we buy in cash, so we're trying to be very opportunistic with companies right now that you know, may be a little bit distressed. You know, we have a really unique story that the business owners like, right? They like that they get to have their cake and eat it, but their employees are also going to be taken care of too, right? And so that's a very unique opportunity as a seller, as a baby boomer who's looking to, you know, move into retirement, and they don't want to be tied to this company after they sell it for 3 to 5 years, like most private equity or most buyers would require. So we bring in our management team. We have a very skilled, very high level management team. You know, our president of manufacturing operations, he spent over 25 years at Toyota, was one of the first people inside Tesla building that, directly working with Elon.
He's got some great stories about Elon.
You know, he's worked in the aerospace sector, the medical sector. So he's been very successful everywhere he goes, and he brings a lot of skill sets. You know, our CFO has 35 years of manufacturing experience. So we've got a very dynamic, diverse team that brings a tremendous experience to running these types of businesses and introducing automation and robotics and, you know, lean manufacturing approaches. So we go into a typical mom and pop family owned business that, you know, if you go in there and start talking about lean, you know, management and lean manufacturing, it lights out and things like that. They're like, no, that's not us. So we can bring all of those advantages to these, these companies are generally one of the largest employers in the markets that they're in, right? So they're very significant companies to their market. If those jobs were lost, it would really hurt those communities. And that's really what we focus on.
A question that I always ask my first-time guests on the show, because we talk about business, we talk about investing, we talk about cash flow, but we also, we talk about legacy and leaving a legacy. So I always ask my first-time guests, if you cannot pass on any money to future generations, but you're only allowed to pass on three principles and values to them to help them achieve success and happiness and build wealth, what would they be?
You want to take it first, or
sure? I guess I can go for that. I think these are things that my parents definitely passed along to me. I'm the oldest of six kids, big family. Dad's worked hard to support us, and I think hard work is crucial. So there's a lot of times when my dad, was traveling all over the country for a job that wasn't paying him enough money, but it put food on the table for us. So I think that's the first one. I think another one is just be likable. I think my dad could talk to a tree, and by the end of the conversation, it would like him. So that's something that I try to, take it hard is, building relationships. And, how I got into this business was just a relationship that I built that I never would have thought would have turned into what it's been and, what we've grown together. One of the partners here, I've known him for years. Those two big, and then, family. Definitely taking care of your family. My wife is, what drives me and, our future kids. So I think that's, something that's super important to me.
Yeah. Well said, Zach. I mean, I'll echo the hard work is, people need to learn to grind. If you want to be successful, I don't care if it's, shoveling sidewalks. You got to grind. I mean, it all comes, you get out what you put in, and that'd be my first principle. I would steal the family from Zach, but I'll give you kind of a different angle there. It is you have to educate yourself you have to constantly learn about your profession. Whatever it is that you do, you have to constantly be evolving and adapting and learning what's coming down the road and how you can deploy this into what you do and take little, even somebody listening to this, if they can take little bite-sized nuggets of this and apply it to what they do. That's how you really ultimately become successful, is taking those little pieces of wisdom and stacking them up over years. And then the third thing I would say is, patience, right? I think we live in a society right now where everybody wants it yesterday and they want the instant lotto ticket. Right. And in my experience in life, that doesn't work, right? You have to just have patience. You have to, give things time to develop and grow, and you got to nurture them and be willing to put in that time and be patient.
Awesome. Awesome. Steve and Zach, this has been great. Where can my listeners and my viewers, where can they get in touch with you? Where can they follow you, and where can they go to get information and stay informed of all of the projects and future projects that you guys are involved with?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is arclp.fund. So that's arclp.fund, like FUND. And our email is just investors@arclp.fund. And so if anybody's interested in learning more about what we do, we'd be happy to schedule some time. There is a link on our website to schedule a call with Zach and I, or one of us, or both of us. You'll be able to get a lot that, the podcasts and presentations and webinars that we've done are all available, in there. And, so it's, we try and provide as much transparency to the market as we can. And we'll work with, any accredited investors, any financial advisors, CPAs that want to learn more about this, any, current real estate developers, that want to get into the stock space. We'd love to talk to you.
Fantastic. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show and providing so much value for my listeners and my viewers. It's been a blast.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having us, MC. Thank you, MC. Appreciate it.
Thank you to all of my listeners and viewers for, again, spending your most valuable resource, your time, once again with me. Everything Cashflow Ninja is at cashflowninja.com. Books, podcasts, webinars, and you can sign up for the best weekly newsletter In the alternative wealth strategy and alternative asset investment space, the Wealth Dojo. Until next time, live infinitely.
This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation, and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.